From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the video game industry is larger than both movies and music. We find out what's new at the year's biggest gaming convention. Then Leslie Manville got an Oscar nomination for Phantom Thread. She's starring in a Hulu series, and she's on stage in Long Day's Journey into Night.
It certainly feels good to be Leslie Manville working right now, because a lot of actresses who I feel for are struggling of a similar age to me. There aren't enough parts to go round.
And Liz Phair revisits a cut from her 1993 debut album, Exit in Guyville. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's Grownish, produced by ABC Signature Studios, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Comedy Series, lead actress Yara Shahidi, and contemporary costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
And National Geographic's One Strange Rock, executive produced by Darren Aronofsky and Newtopia and hosted by Will Smith, the Emmy-eligible series takes viewers on a trip around the world. NatGeoTV.com/FYC.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The biggest gaming convention of the year kicked off today at the Los Angeles Convention Center. The Electronic Entertainment Expo, or E3, offers fans and industry workers a glimpse into the latest developments in games and technologies. Todd Martins writes about video games for the LA Times. He's attending E3 today. So when I spoke with him, I started by asking him to describe the mood on the convention hall floor.
It's definitely sort of an information overload. It's almost sort of like stepping into a casino or a hotel in Las Vegas. There's no windows. You're just like bombarded with noises, lights. Everywhere you turn, you're being hyped some sort of new game. You know, it's a little bit toned down than it has been in, you know, 5-10 years ago. There were, you know, a lot more costumes and a lot more characters running around. But in recent years, it's pretty much all sort of screen-based and very loud.
Why is it important to the industry? What are they trying to accomplish with consumers or trade press or marketing? What's the goal here?
I mean, it's kind of shifted because in recent years, E3 used to be geared primarily toward retailers and journalists. The retail has shifted more toward online and download purchases. In terms of the games media, that's shifted as well. So now you see a lot of YouTube personalities. So you see a lot of sort of people who are working much more closely with the game companies than, you know, traditional sort of journalists who are there reporting on things. And last year they opened it to the public. So they're trying to make it a little bit more of a fan-focused event. In terms of doing that, they've added a whole thing called the E3 Coliseum, which is 3 days of talks with game makers and filmmakers. So basically, think of it as sort of like a gathering to just go watch and play what would be the equivalent of movie trailers. And so you get a sense of what's going to be coming out over the next year or two, and you get a sense of what is going to be the priority for these major studios.
So last year, interactive entertainment generated more than $100 billion in revenues. And if you're keeping score, that's more than the global movie and home entertainment business. And mobile games make up about 60% of those sales. So where are the companies trying to grow? Are they developing new gaming platforms, technologies? What are they looking at in terms of trying to figure out how they're going to get that big piece of the pie even bigger?
I mean, Microsoft did tease that they are working on a new console. You heard Bethesda say they're developing a next game for next gen. Presumably, that means they're developing it for the next generation of consoles. But you've also heard a number of studios talk about streaming, because we're entering a sort of phase where the mobile area is growing and the mobile area is bringing in more games. But in terms of, you know, consoles and PCs, there's a high barrier to entry. It costs hundreds of dollars to play, to buy. Streaming, in theory, will allow you to, say, play a game that you could only once play on a high-powered PC on your TV. So it's still early going, but that's going to be a big growth model, is can the video game sort of create what would sort of be a Netflix?
A lot of kids I know, including my youngest son, are obsessed with a game called Fortnite. It's known as a battle royale game while you're playing with other people online. And right now it's bigger than Star Wars or the Avengers. The game made an estimated $300 million in the month of April, entirely on purchases like costumes that the characters can wear. Why is Fortnite so hot right now? And like Hollywood, are there lots of other companies that are trying to develop knockoffs or imitators?
Fortnite, I think the reason it's connecting is because, A, it's a little goofy in terms of shooter-based games. You're able to create a lot of memes from the game. You see a lot of images of these characters dancing. You see a lot of sort of outrageous characters with all these costumes people are buying. And it's also another sort of aspect of like being social online. It is essentially a social platform. Pretty much every studio so far that does multiplayer has announced that they're making a Battle Royale type game. Battle Royale is what Fortnite sort of specializes in, which is sort of a last man standing sort of game. But you're also seeing lots of variations within that. And within Fortnite, is it allows players to sort of create their own sort of games.
In your preview of E3, you wrote that there are some very topical games coming out. I want to ask you about Sea of Solitude and Wolfenstein Youngblood and how they reflect what's going on in the country right now and why you think they're important.
Sea of Solitude I thought was really intriguing. And the woman who's designing that game, it's a very personal game for her. She developed it after trying to conquer various forms of depression. Essentially, there's a young woman in the game, her name is Kay, who is suffering from suicidal thoughts, severe depression. So she essentially sort of turns into a monster. And the game is sort of figuring out how she can, like, again, see herself in a healthy light. It's a game about self-preservation, and it seems like that's what a lot of people are trying to figure out these days.
And Wolfenstein, like Battlefield 5, has made some headlines for having female characters in combat in World War II. What are those games about, and what's the reaction been?
I think Wolfenstein is going to be actually a little bit more interesting. This is a game that's sort of like Man in the High Castle. It's sort of an alternate reality where the Axis won World War II. This game features two women as the lead, these two twins, and they're basically starting a revolution to fight, the Nazi Empire. But also, Wolfenstein seems a little bit political. You're having two female characters in 2018 essentially battling an army of white supremacists.
As somebody who not only writes about games but actually plays games, was there something you saw that as a gamer that you're really looking forward to that you will be quick to play as soon as it's available?
I am really looking forward to The Last of Us 2. Sony showed that last night at its press conference. It's a zombie game, but it's a zombie game in that it really is about more personal issues. And this game looks like, from what they showed last night, is going to focus on the character of Ellie, a young woman. We also saw her kiss another woman. We also often don't see, LGBTQ characters in games. So that's sort of exciting in that we get to sort of play a different type of character we haven't played before in this sort of very stressful, harrowing, zombie sort of atmosphere.
Todd Martins covers video games for the LA Times. Todd, thanks for taking time off from the floor to give us an E3 update.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, after playing Daniel Day-Lewis's sister in the period drama Phantom Thread, Leslie Manville goes further back in time for a classic Eugene O'Neill play.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's global event series, Genius. The new season stars Antonio Banderas as Spanish painter Pablo Picasso, one of the most influential and celebrated artists of the 20th century. Antonio and Picasso both hail from the same hometown, Malaga, Spain, where the production spent several days filming, including in the same house where Picasso was born. The series is Emmy eligible in all categories. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information. Don't just consider, explore.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The British actor Leslie Manville is having quite a moment. She earned an Oscar nomination for her role in Paul Thomas Anderson's movie Phantom Thread last year. She played Cyril, the sister of Daniel Day-Lewis's character, the fashion designer Reynolds Woodcock.
No, don't turn it on me. I don't want your cloud on my head.
Shut up, Cyril.
You can shut right up. Don't pick a fight with me. You certainly won't come out alive. I'll go right through you, and it'll be you who ends up on the floor. Understood?
Manville is also in the Hulu series Harlots, which returns for season 2 next month, and she's about to go into production on a movie with Liam Neeson. But her first love is theater, and that's where I sat down with her yesterday. Manville is currently starring in a production of Eugene O'Neill's autobiographical family drama, Long Day's Journey into Night. She's opposite Jeremy Irons at the Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts in Beverly Hills. Manville plays Mary, the morphine-addicted matriarch of the Tyrone family. When I sat down with Manville at the Wallace, she began with how she got into the part of Mary Tyrone, a character that she first played in another production of this play 2 years ago in Bristol.
I did research into morphine addiction and how that affects somebody and the speed it would affect you and the ups of it and the downs of it and all of that. But of course, you start with a supremely brilliant piece of writing, which is obviously very heartfelt because it is the story of Eugene O'Neill's family. So he's writing first-hand experience.
Even though this story is set more than 100 years ago, I think it unfolds in 1912, is that right?
Mm.
And it was written well before it was published. I mean, I think it sat on the shelf for almost 15 years before it was published after O'Neill's death. Do you feel that either in the story of the marriage, in the story of the drug addiction, or in the story of parenting, that in some ways the Tyrones share a lot with modern couples and modern families?
Definitely. I mean, at the press afternoon yesterday, the audience I was talking to afterwards, I mean, I had two women in particular who came up to me who found it quite hard to speak, and they were very tearful, and they said it was sadly their family's story. And I know that there's a lot going on here now surrounding opiate addiction, and so it's relevant. It is, I mean, yes, the play is set in 1912. It was first performed in 1956, which was 3 years after his death, although he had written in his will that he didn't want it performed for 25 years after his death, but his wife managed to overturn it. Presumably she saw what a wonderful piece of writing it was. And so it was performed first in 1956. But it is just about a family and their addictions and their problems and their issues of trying to keep themselves together and be in denial about certain things that are going on.
But it's also a story about artists and about what that calling or what that career can mean to different people, and about how certain people in the story see themselves, how they want to be seen, and then what they are unable to do in support of somebody else's dream. And that, to me, is maybe the most modern part of the story, that for your character, she has had to take a back seat to her husband's career because he has sucked all the air out of the room, so to speak.
He certainly has. And I think that, you know, she, as I say in the play, Mary was a young convent girl, 18, when she was 16 when she met him. And he was this matinee idol, good-looking guy, and he swept her off her feet. And she put aside all thoughts of being a nun or a pianist, and she married him thinking she was going to have this wonderful life. But it turned out to be a pretty hideous life because she was just on the road with him. She didn't feel at home in the theatre or with the people involved with the theatre. So she sat in hotel rooms. And because he was a miser, she sat in not particularly nice hotel rooms. No TV, no mobile phone, no cell phones. She had a pretty dire existence. She lost a child, and then he made her have another one to take its place. But then he would make her leave the children at home with nannies so she could go on the road with him. I mean, selfish, selfish man. But I work very hard for the audience to see the pain that Mary's lived through and the situations and the circumstances she's had to endure, because I want them to understand what's driven her to morphine.
Do you get a tangible sense from performance to performance, city to city, whether or not they're with you? Can you feel that differently given different audiences, different venues, yes, whether or not they are with you and with Mary?
I can hear a pin drop. I get quite excited when that happens because I know that they are really, really listening. And there's a lot of speeches that I have. We all have, all the characters actually have quite big speeches, but she has rather a lot. And I really can feel the audience with me. But there is a difference in the audiences because, you know, in London, you're playing to a very, you know, generally speaking, a culturally stimulated audience because they've got theatre on their doorstep and it's a theatre town, as is New York. And you sort of feel it's different here because it's not such a theatre city. It's all about the movies and TV.
I've talked to so many American actors and actresses who start in small theaters. Maybe they get a touring show. Maybe they're lucky enough to get something on Broadway. And from there, almost always, the trajectory is toward film and television. And that maybe, if they have the time, they can go back and do some theater. It feels like your career is almost the opposite of that, that theater is so integral to who you are as a performer that it's the television and film work that is more the exception to the rule rather than the destination.
It's not the exception to the rule, but it's certainly... I grew up and started working in a generation when you didn't really think about coming to LA for pilot season or coming to the States at all. You know, I worked a huge amount in theatre in England in my early years. And for me then, television and films was an exception. Then in my 20s, I met Mike Lee, so I started working with him quite a lot. So it opened it all up. But now, I think, I feel sorry for younger actors now. I think the pressure is on for them to, you know, tweet their lives, Instagram everything, audition on an iPhone. It's really, really sorry state of affairs. But I mean, I hadn't done a play in the gap between Long Day's Journey in Bristol and then when we did it in London, and that was nearly 2 years, and I didn't do a play at all because I was doing, you know, Phantom Thread. I was shooting Harlots, which is a series I do for Hulu, and another series that I do for the BBC called Mum. So I was, you know, busy in those territories, but I will always want to do a play. And I think British actors and New York-based actors do seek that because it's a balance. It's a really good balance, and I wouldn't want to ever not be on stage for too long because it is, in my opinion, the ultimate test. You can edit around a not very good performance on television or film. You can't edit on stage. The audience can look at you for the whole 3.5 hours if they want, and you've got to deliver. And I like the fact that nobody shouts cut and that the evening is our responsibility. And I see it as a kind of arc, you know, and you have to begin it, middle it, and end it. And it's your responsibility. And so there's a control over the evening, which you don't have on film.
Let me ask you this last question. You are doing Long Day's Journey in Beverly Hills. You recently did a movie with Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis. You have a Hulu series. It feels like wherever you go, there's tremendous opportunities. Does it feel good to be an actor working right now?
It certainly feels good to be Leslie Manville working right now because I'm having an absolute field day. I mean, it's quite extraordinary given that a lot of actresses who I feel for are struggling of a similar age to me to get enough, there are enough parts to go round. So I'm carrying a bit of guilt about it, but I, you know, I have to allow myself some celebration as well. I am having the most extraordinary time, and I know that I've worked for over 40 years, and a lot of it's to do with putting in that time. But there's no doubt about it, an Oscar nomination makes a hell of a difference. And I would have never thought that that was the case with somebody as seasoned as myself. But it does, and it has changed things, no doubt about it.
Leslie Manville, great to see you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Leslie Manville stars with Jeremy Irons in Long Day's Journey, and tonight is at the Wallace in Beverly Hills through July 1st. Coming up, Liz Phair revisits a cut from her 1993 debut album for a new edition of Song Exploder.
KPCC supporters include HBO presenting Game of Thrones. Summers span decades, winters can last a lifetime. In the epic season of this colossal hit, the people of Westeros fight for their seat on the Iron Throne. Winter is here, and beyond the Great Wall that protects them, a forgotten evil has returned. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. And now it's time for Song Exploder. That's the podcast from our pal Hrishikesh Hirway, in which musicians deconstruct how they created a song. Today, it's Liz Phair. In 1993, she released her debut album, Exile in Guyville. Spin and the Village Voice named it Album of the Year. Now, 25 years later, Exile in Guyville has been reissued as a deluxe box set. Exile in Guyville's producer, Brad Wood, joined Liz Phair to talk with Hrishi for a recent episode of Song Exploder, and they discussed the creation of one cut on the album, Divorce Song.
I'm Liz Phair. I don't remember when I wrote Divorce Song, but I remember the evening that inspired it. I must have been a sophomore or junior in college. I was dating a guy at Oberlin, and he had this little blue Miata. One night we went for a ride, and I think we drove through cornfields. So it was kind of like this night where I didn't know how I felt about him. I didn't know how he felt about me, but we had a really good time together. And I wanted to write about all the little in-between moments that people have with a relationship. I had a four-track, a microphone, an electric guitar, and a little PV amp. I didn't work very hard on it because I thought I was a visual artist who just happened to write songs on the side. I didn't think I was a musician.
Liz Phair used the name Girly Sound for these recordings.
Girly Sound was an art provocative piece in my mind. The young female voice carries the least authority in society. And so I wanted to see if you had a little girl voice, which I sort of did, what you could get away with saying. So I made one cassette of songs and two copies. That was it.
Hi, I'm Brad Wood. I heard the Girly Sound tapes. That was at John Henderson's apartment. John Henderson lived in Chicago like we all did and ran a couple of small indie labels. I remember Divorce Song specifically, and that song resonated with me more than any other song she's written. And I'll never forget walking home with like this nervous calculation, how can I help make this happen? I was going to be the engineer for that session, and John made it clear that he and Liz were going to produce it, or just he.
John, he was such a music head, and he did play all this great music. He was constantly like, listen to this. Guys were constantly lecturing me about what good music was and like what band I should listen to. And it was just like constant school. He was really adamant in the studio about what he wanted to do and what he didn't want to do. And I felt suddenly what I hadn't really cared about before, I felt like he was taking too much ownership over it. And I didn't like at all the sensation of him telling me what could and couldn't be on my songs. And it kind of triggered something in me. And this defiant person came up out of me that was like, no. So I split with John Henderson, and I didn't want to do it anymore.
I was disappointed that we weren't going to record anymore. So I called John and asked if I could get a number for Liz, and I called her at her parents' house. Eventually, we did connect enough to agree to record again. When Liz first came into the studio, we plugged into different guitar amps to see what worked. And Liz was most comfortable playing through her PV Backstage, which is an inexpensive...
Portable,
small little amp. And so we put it through a chorus pedal. It has a stereo output, so one cable would come out and go into Liz's PV amp, and then we'd plug in a second amp. So she would play one guitar part through two amplifiers, and then we could pan it left-right.
remember sitting there and you would solo my vocal for some technical reason.
And when I asked for a separate room, it was late at night and we've been driving since noon.
And when I first heard my voice back over the big speakers, I wanted to die. Every second that that vocal was up there in that room, I was sitting on the couch in a state of seizure. I think my voice was too thin.
At that time, I had more confidence in her singing ability than she had. And my agenda with this song specifically was that a song so harrowing lyrically that's painting such a bleak picture that unfortunately all of us probably at some time experience, whether it's divorce or just a relationship dying, I thought that it was best communicated in as stark a setting as possible.
But when you said that I wasn't worth talking to, I had to take your word on that.
I had really specific ideas for the rhythm parts for this song, and a lot of that comes from Liz's guitar style. She does a lot of accents off the beat, doesn't play on the downbeat. The really obvious thing to do would be to play a drum pattern that hits those accents, but I had been taught never overplay.
When you're in a car with someone, that's a pretty intimate environment. And for me, Divorce Song is really about that tension in that kind of, you're looking at him, he's looking at you, you're both having totally different thoughts about each other, and yet you're like stuck in this small confined space together. I didn't make these songs to start a career. I made these songs because they were my way of understanding the world. They were my therapy.
That was singer-songwriter Liz Phair and record producer Brad Wood. You can hear a longer version of their conversation on songexploder.net. And one quick word as we head out. A federal judge late today approved AT&T's $85 billion takeover of Time Warner. The Justice Department had tried to block the deal, which was announced in late 2016, over concerns that the combined companies would hurt consumers. The announcement is likely to complicate the Walt Disney Company's efforts to acquire 21st Century Fox. Comcast, which already owns NBC Universal, has also been kicking the tires at Fox. And now that AT&T has been approved to buy Time Warner, it could announce a competing bid for Fox as soon as tomorrow. That is it for today. I'm John Horn. We'll be back here tomorrow. That it's harder to be friends and love.